Welcome to the Eucharist Podcast with Wyoming Catholic College, responding to the call for Eucharistic renewal by sharing wisdom in God's country. I'm Jeremy Holmes, Academic Dean at Wyoming Catholic College.
And I'm Kyle Washit, its President, and welcome to this episode.
Kyle and I are here today with Dr. Scott Olson, who not only teaches in our math and science sequence and has taught in our philosophy sequence, but has spent a great deal of time over the years in our Latin program. And we wanted to talk with Dr. Olson today about a poem from an unlikely source. Kyle and I have been talking about the sort of the metaphysical finer points of Eucharistic doctrine according to St. Thomas Aquinas, but few people know that St. Thomas actually wrote some really beautiful poetry about the Eucharist. And today we're going to look at a poem that many people know only in part. That is, many of us know this poem as the O Salutaris Hostia, but that turns out to be just the last bit of a longer poem by St. Thomas that begins, Verbum supernum proteans. Is this commonly rendered in English? Is this something that is in the hymnals?
I'm not going to know that answer. I don't know.
I don't believe I've ever seen this entire hymn in a hymnal, you know, in English and available to the people. So this is...
Certainly not a Byzantine liturgy, so that's
right. Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay.
I thought that perhaps what we could do is just work our way bit by bit through the poem. It may be, Dr. Olson, for the sake of our listeners, saying what it means in English. it begins, Verbum supernum proteans. Nec patris linquens dexterum. Ad opus suum exiens venit ad vitae vesperam. How would we get that into English?
Well, if it's okay, I'll give a very stilted, hyper-literal English translation.
That's my favorite.
Because there are some beautiful things happening in the Latin which can easily be lost, I think, in an English translation. So we've got something like an up-above word coming out, but not departing from, not abandoning the right hand of the Father, going out to do his own job, his own work. He came to the evening of his life.
Okay.
So that's, obviously that's not.
If this is in a hymnal somewhere, that's not on what
that's not the translation.
This is why it doesn't make it in the hymnals. Now we know. All right.
Yeah, there are a lot of really rich words already in that opening four lines, that opening quatrain, which are pretty interesting. Proteans, for example, sometimes gets translated as descending or coming out or emerging. It's used by Caesar to mean it's what soldiers do when they go out to battle. They prodire. It's used in some authors, what a flower does when it emerges from the soil. It's what a play actor does when he comes onto stage. So there's a lot of rich meaning there.
Yeah, but here we have the eternal word of the Father within the eternity of the Trinity, and he's going to emerge like a soldier onto the battlefield, or like a flower blossoming from eternity into time.
Right, he's coming onto stage. He was present, but now will be apparent. Linquens, nec patris linquens dexterum, sometimes has a kind of a negative connotation, like to abandon. So he's not doing that. He's not abandoning. And it's not just that he's not abandoning the Father. He's not abandoning this position, the right hand, the dexterum of the Father. So he's right. He's still right there.
So he's coming forth into time while staying in eternity. He's the soldier marching onto the field while still remaining with the general. He's the actor coming onto stage but he's still backstage. This is right. The mystery of the incarnation right here.
And that word patris, which the poem begins with, so the whole thing begins with Christ with the Father, the poem will return to the word patris in a sort of hidden way at the end of the poem. Mm-hmm. So there's a, mm-hmm. when we get patria, but.
Yeah, so he goes forth to do, you said, to his job, to do his work. He came to the evening of his life. And it seems clear that we're talking about he's about to die. We've set the stage in the Gospels just before the Passion. We are, in fact, we'll find as we go on Holy Thursday, right before he's betrayed.
And there, I just even like the phrase that's the evening of his life, as in both toward the end of his life, but also in a certain sense, as we go to Holy Thursday, this is, in a sense, the evening of the Lord's life. This is what his work is for,
yeah.
is this evening.
And there's a psalm that is used again and again in the Liturgy of the Hours that describes the sun coming forth like a bridegroom from his chamber and rejoicing to run his course. And that psalm is always interpreted as representing Christ coming forth. And I hear echoes of this here, where he comes forth like the sun rising over the world. And he's had lived his life brilliantly, and now he's come to his evening. And in a way, this he's about to set.
Maybe one other thing to say about that first quatrain is the opening words, verbum superandum proteans, are words used in a previously, an earlier hymn, maybe from as early as the 5th century, so about the Nativity. So Thomas is also not ripping off, but quoting or maybe referring back to that hymn about the Nativity.
Okay, so we've got a previous hymn going on. We're echoing a psalm. We have all this rich imagery around proteanes. Into the second quatrain, let's see. How does that go in English?
Another stilted, awful translation.
Okay, play it on us.
Let's see. About to be handed over to his rivals into a death by his disciple. Before that, he gave himself to his disciples as a dish of life, in a dish of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now, again, the sound of the Latin is great. In morte mate scipolo, suis tradendus amulis, prius in vite ferculo, se tradedit de scipolis. It's very rhythmic, moves right along in a way that translationist is not going to
exactly.
capture.
In particular, the word order, which is so free in Latin, allows some kind of word imagery, some structural imagery. So you get at the very beginning a discipulo, and at the very end discipulis. There's a gift, or there's a handing over, which is done by his disciple, obviously, unfortunately, you know, a bad
Judas. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's his own freely handing over to his disciples, and those are paired not only by the word discipulo and discipulis, but also tradendus. And trotted it.
Yeah, the same verb in Latin at the root here. And so we have this comparison between Christ being handed over by Judas and Christ himself doing a bit of handing over before that
right.
to the disciples in a dish of life. Vitae ferculo.
Right, which you want to say something like a feast of life. But ferculum is like a dish, you know, like a...
It's the platter. Yeah.
Course.
Okay.
At a banquet.
Okay. Yeah.
One thing that's really striking also about the word order there is that Thomas is careful to say that he gave himself to the disciples before, he uses the word prius, before he's the treachery of Judas. But the treachery, the tradendus of Judas is placed before. So it sort of suggests there's a foreknowing, I think.
So he knows that Judas is about to do this, and he's going to beat Judas to the punch by handing himself over before Judas can.
Exactly.
It has the other effect of that first quatrain we talked about, having echoes of the Nativity, echoes of just the Trinitarian life. In a certain sense, it's also then saying what happens after is also contained. So this evening of the Lord's life that we're talking about contains, in a sense, the mystery of the Trinitarian word. It contains the mystery of his nativity, the mystery of his life, the work that he's done. But it also anticipates the handing over that's going to come from Judas and the subsequent passion and suffering and resurrection. So that this, even the word order is stressing the kind of intensification or collapsing of time into this dish that we're approaching.
One more comment on the word. You had said handed over to his rivals, and that's right. That's exactly what Amelis means. It's often translated enemies, but it is a little bit more specific than that, and it seems to me to capture a nuance of the story, that those who want Jesus dead are precisely those who want to have his power, whether it's the temporal power not wanting him to be a temporal king, or whether it's the spiritual authorities not wanting the Messiah to be there.
Mm-hmm. Right, we might translate it as imitators.
Mm-hmm. So going on into the third quatrain, the Latin sounds like this before we get to the English butchery. It goes like this. Quibus subina specie carnum dedit et sanguinem, ut duplicis substantiae totum cibaret hominem. All right, take us through the English.
Okay. And actually, I'll do that, but I have to say that I take exception to the way this is typically translated. So I'll give my, I think, better translation.
That's why we're here. Yeah.
Okay, and then we can talk about that. So it refers back to the disciples who we just heard about in the previous quatrain. So he gave his flesh and his blood to those under a twofold appearance, or maybe a twofold species, so that he might feed the whole man of a twofold substance.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
So this is sometimes translated in the translation. I have a translation in front of me that says, Chibaret imparting his whole person, as if Chibaret could mean he to give himself. But it means, I think, it must mean that he's feeding the whole man.
Yeah, and you know, and behind this, it's helpful to be aware of what St. Thomas is working with in the patristic tradition, because from St. Ambrose, he has gotten the idea that the Eucharist is under the appearances of both bread and wine, offers both the body and the blood, among other reasons, to nourish both man's body and his soul.
Mm-hmm.
The bread for the body, the blood for the soul, the blood being that in which the life is found in Scripture, right? And so by nourishing both man's body and his soul, he's nourishing the whole man, which is exactly, right, exactly what you're saying. So we have a twofold appearance in the Eucharist to correspond to a sort of twofold nature of man. We're both material and spiritual.
Right, and those coming together, the two, the carnum and the sanguinum, the blood and the body, and the twofold substance of man, it seems to me to suggest a kind of, a communion between Christ and man that's happening. And it's sort of mirrored figuratively in quatrain.
And there's a kind of play on the twofold species or the twofold appearance. Namely, in one sense, the appearance is twofold. Namely, there's bread over here and wine over here. But in another sense, what the appearance signifies is a kind of twofold thing. On the one hand, it signifies the substance of the body of Christ and the substance of the blood of Christ. But it also signifies this twofold nature of every man. So you've got sort of, on the one hand, the signification that Jeremy and I talked about in a previous episode, the signification of the separation of the body and the blood, but also it's now a signification of just the human person, that the blood itself is a sign of an invisible reality of the human soul. And so this twofold species has this fun play on, like, it's a not just twofold species, but what it signifies, what it says appearance of is twofold. And I don't know how explicit Aquinas is trying to make that, but it's a fun play that he's doing there.
Yeah, and this is very compact as poetry, and never more than in the fourth quatrain, which I have to say is my favorite part of this whole poem. It's four parallel lines, and the Latin sounds like this: Se nasciens dedit socium, conversiens in edulium, se moriens in pretium, se regnans dat in premium.
It is beautiful, isn't it?
And just beautiful to hear, even when you don't know what it means, just the words roll over the ear sonorously. But take us through an English rendering of that.
Okay, so being born, he gave himself as a partner, eating together as an edible thing, dying as the price. He gives himself ruling as a reward.
So we have four stages in the life of Christ, the life of the incarnate word, right? We have the stage of the birth, the Christmas mystery, right? We have our current stage, which is reclining at dinner on Holy Thursday. We have the stage about to come after Judas betrays him, the stage of death. And then we have the final stage of his reigning in heaven. And each of those stages has a gift to offer.
Mm-hmm. In the first three lines, this is really emphasized, the quatrain is sort of divided into what's already happened and what is ongoing very clearly, because in the first three lines, you've got one verb, which he did, that he gave himself as an ally, as a friend, as a partner. But that verb dedit is not repeated. So it's implied for the next two lines.
Right. But then in the fourth line, he replaces that past tense verb with a present tense
exactly.
verb.
So which is why I said he now gives. Now is not present there, but it's an ongoing, continuous sort of giving that he's doing. There's also this kind of sense of continuity and movement, I feel, because of the continued participles that we get. Nasciens, conversiens, moriens, regnans.
Mm-hmm.
Which not only sort of unify the quatrain, but also just make the action feel ongoing. The word socium is interesting. He gave himself a socium in birth. It's often translated a friend, but it's where we get words like society. So he's not a kind of friendly God who's distant and sort of smiling at this thing's happening. He's sort of entered into the society.
He became one of us.
Yeah,
when he was born.
Yeah, he's. Right. It's a word that's used sometimes. It's a partner in a business arrangement, even. You know, so he's got skin in the game. You know.
Yeah,
literally.
Yeah. Yeah, and that really does seem to encapsulate, I think, the Christmas joy, right? The Christmas joy is that Christ, that God now is one of us. He's here, enduring whatever we endure. We're not alone anymore. We have God as our socius.
And then there's this play, right? We think, well, what do you do with socius? I think both of, well, you have a dinner companion, like this is someone you break bread with, or it's someone, as Scott said, you go into business with. But then in giving himself as our companion, he then gives himself as not just someone who breaks bread with us, but as the bread we break, and not just someone who goes into business deals with us, but as the price we pay. Mm-hmm. So that there's this consumingness of the way he's our companion. That it would have sufficed us. Was he just our friend? Was he just with us? But in fact, no, not only is he just with us, he's also the food that you would eat with your friend and the price that you would pay with your business partner.
Yeah, and you clearly hear the price of our redemption.
Yes.
He gives himself as the price. But that's interesting too, that after this life of giving himself, Thomas indicates he's not done. His gift doesn't end when he's done dying for us. Now he's waiting as the king to give himself to each of us as a reward.
And there I just think of the beautiful story of St. Thomas, where after he'd written so beautifully about the Eucharist, he's in the chapel praying, and the Lord asks him in that moment, what do you want as your reward? And he says,
Non nisi te, Domine.
Yet only you.
Nothing but you.
Only you, Lord. And there's that sense of longing that you know that's on his heart that's coming out in that line. And then, for all of this, all we want is you.
Now, at this point, we do sort of get to the lines that I think people are more familiar with that do show up in the hymnals. I think everyone is, or many will be familiar with, you know, even the melody, right? O salutaris ostia, right? One melody that one hears. Is there anything out of the last two quatrains that stands out to you as perhaps hidden in the usual translations?
Sure. You've got in O Salutaris Hostia, there's clearly wordplay between hostia and ostium. Those sound very similar. And so he's equating somehow, figuratively, the sacrificial victim, the hostia, with the door, the ostium. Pondus means to open. You're opening the door of heaven, but it's sort of throwing wide. And I might go out on a limb and say that it might be historically connected to suffering, mm-hmm. which is interesting. The fourth principal part of Pondus for you Latinists out there is passus, which is kind of interesting. So there's some connection he might be aware of there. Somehow by the opening the door is going to happen somehow through suffering. Robur, da robur, you know, which is usually translated as strength, initially means a strong oak tree. So it's this kind of vigorous, lively strength, a living strength.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so here we have, you know, I guess, literally, saving victim who you were suggesting throws wide the gate of heaven.
Who is the gate also?
Yeah,
you know,
is the gate and throws wide the gate because of that wordplay. The enemies are pressing war on us, and then there's this request. Give strength, and you're saying the oak tree is in the background
yep.
of this massive strength. Fair and bear aid, you know. Mm-hmm. Give us.
So maybe not give a kind of strength which is like a dead wall or a shield, but like a kind of living strength.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a striking stanza. Well, and that's why I think it gets translated in hymns. But it's also a striking stanza in comparison to the previous four, right? The previous four is this kind of deep, careful meditation on the eternal reality of the Word and his saving mission. And this turns into a like passionate plea in the midst of a battle. And it's a kind of sharp transition with the only tradition, maybe the link, certainly in words, being the focus on giving. He has given this, he will give this, and now I'm just addressing him directly and asking him, give me this, help, to get to
the moon. And the attention up to this point has all been the story of Christ.
Right.
All the way up to his reigning in heaven, and suddenly the spotlight swings onto us, the ones singing. And here we are. Our story is far from over. We're in the midst of battle. We could really use some oak tree style help right now.
Mm-hmm. I really like what you said, though. It's the first time we get a direct address and an invocation.
Yeah, I wonder just there as a side note, whether that says something about the way that Aquinas is thinking of meditating on the Eucharistic theology and the mystery of Christ's redemptive work, is that the natural end of that is not, you know, an appendix to a treatise, but turning to the Lord and directly addressing him from the midst of our mess. That the result of meditating upon the mystery of the Last Supper and the mystery of Christ's saving work is that now I'm talking to him. That fourth stanza, that he's my companion, my food, the natural result of that is that I just cry out to him from my pain and say, help me.
Yeah, we're very clearly in this story now.
Yeah.
Suddenly the bella hostilia premunt, the hostile, you know, the wars are waging about us, pressing in on us, which is, a clear departure from the story that we had been listening to. Yeah.
And then having begged for help, we nonetheless turn in a kind of serenity to say, to the one and triune Lord be eternal glory. We're just like, this is not finally about us. Who, the Lord, will give us life without end in the patria, And I think you were gonna land us with that word.
Well, so may he grant, not will grant, although.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so it is. So it's again a prayer. May he grant life without end to us. And in patria, that's often translated in as native land or homeland, but you could hear in the word itself, patria, etymologically a connection with the word pater, so a return to the fatherland.
Mm-hmm. So as the word himself has gone forth from the Father and then returns to the Father, so we are asking that we be brought to life without end in the Father and in the fatherland.
Thank you for listening to the Eucharistic Podcast at Wyoming Catholic College. To learn more about Wyoming Catholic College, visit wyomingcatholic.edu.